I've been calling for a tax reform. First, it's, I think, very essential that we simplify our tax forms. It's inexcusable that those of us who have learned to read can't fill out our tax forms, but they've made it so complicated that it takes an expert to help each of us get it done. Second, the rate of taxation is very inequitable. The woman who scrubs the floor for a Mobile oil company pays a higher rate, a higher percentage on her tax than does the company itself or the president of the company. Now, there's got to be a more uniform distribution of rates by the elimination of tax shelters.
Sir, how do you feel about the drilling on the eastern seaboard, drilling for oil, and also what are your feelings about nuclear energy?
Well, in the best of all possible worlds, I would hope that we could avoid the environmental risks that are involved in going forward with nuclear reactors and in offshore drilling. The problem we face is that in this imperfect world, we have become hostage to the political and economic blackmail of the oil-producing and exporting countries, OPEC countries. At the time we were embargoed last, 31% of our oil was coming in from overseas. Today, in the face of all the talk about project independence, 45% is coming in from overseas. And we know from what the Soviet Union is preaching that they intend to make mischief right after the next election in order to try to get another embargo and another quadrupling or quintupling of oil prices. Now, faced with that kind of a problem, we could find ourselves absolutely unable to provide food and water for our people without energy at some future year. And I think it's very important for us then to go forward with intelligent consideration of environmental constraints with the necessary energy producing programs in this country. I've been calling for a major domestic energy program, which would include offshore production, but with intelligent environmental constraints. Yes?
I have a question. What is your stand on the closing of some of the government installations? In the phasing out of some of them, how do you stand on it? Are you in for helping to close them or to help keep some of them open to have a strong defense in that line?
Well, the tragic problem that we face is that the defense of this country has been cut back in terms of divisions, ships, aircraft, tanks, to the point where not only the odds are would we lose a conventional military war, but furthermore, we have now a greater infrastructure, a greater shore establishment in the case of the Navy, than we need to support the inadequate Navy that remains. And for that reason, some tightening of the facilities was necessary. Indeed, it took us nearly 5 years under the Nixon Ford administration to get approval to reduce the bases that were eliminated so that we could have a leaner, tougher, and more cost-effective establishment. Now, I believe that the services are pretty well down to the point where there isn't too much remaining fat. That's certainly true with regard to the very large majority of facilities with which I'm familiar in the case of the Navy, because we have now cut back a very large number of them.
What direction do you think we should go in the Navy? Below the surface, below or air, or?
Excuse me, before we answer, why don't we stand up and get closer,
because
it's real hard to
move.
Proceedings
were outside. Well, I was asking what direction do you think we should go in the Navy in terms of, should it be surface craft or undersea, or?
I think it takes a mix and a balance. If you have exclusively a submarine Navy, you have no way to defend against the cruise missile or the enemy airplane attacking you. It's going to be many generations before the submarine can deal with that threat. You need aircraft or surface-to-air missiles, and this means you've got to have some surface craft to get them up into the air. The problem that we have faced is that the Congress has not been willing to be intelligent about supporting Navy initiatives with regard to the cheaper ships that would make it possible for us not to have all our eggs in one basket. The Congress killed the sea control ship, a ship which would have made it possible to have 17 or 18 aircraft at sea in 8 platforms, 8 ships for the cost of a single nuclear-propelled aircraft carrier. The Congress killed it. Absolutely inexcusable on the part of the Congress to have done this.
Is there a Russian ship you could compare that to?
The sea control ship lives in the Soviet Navy. They've got the first 2 already, and they're building the 3rd one. The first one is operating, the second one is in the fitting out stage, and the Soviet Navy will continue to produce this highly efficient type of ship, while the Congress will make it increasingly difficult for us to optimize ourselves. This is why I think it's very important for, amidst that committee of 100 senators, to have one who knows what he's talking about with regard to maritime capability.
I have a local question, Mr. Zumwalt. I live 2 miles from the bridge in Northern Virginia. Metro wants to charge me 90 cents each way to get me to work. At the same time, the bus company deficit is heading up towards $50 million a year, which means my property taxes are going up. At 90 cents each way, it's almost cheaper for me to drive. What are you going to do in the Senate about getting Northern Virginians to work?
Right. Well, I think the basic problem here is the fact that we have not been intelligent about our metropolitan planning. When I first moved into Northern Virginia in 1953, it took me 15 minutes to get to work in the Pentagon. Living in the same home 15 years later, it took me 50 minutes. Meanwhile, we had widened all the roads and dumped more and more traffic onto them and created greater and greater bottlenecks down in the metropolitan area. Now, there are a whole conglomerate of jurisdictions involved. We need an overall planning approach to deal with the traffic problems of the district of suburban Maryland and of suburban Virginia, and the study process leading to the solution needs to be done in the light of the overall metropolitan problem. I am of the view that as we become increasingly more urban in this area, we're going to have to be able to have a mass transit system that works. And I think that the statistics that you cite are worrisome because we haven't yet solved those kind of problems. I think that a metropolitan-wide approach will make it possible for us to have the intelligent mix of metro rail systems, metro bus, and commuter cars with hopefully ever larger number of carpool numbers.
Admiral, yes. Senator Scott would probably be more beatable 2 years from now. Particularly when you consider your campaign in other parts of the state. Why did you take on Byrd rather than wait for Senator Scott?
Well, it would have been nice if the good Lord had given me Senator Scott in 1976 instead of Senator Harry Byrd, Jr. But the problems that Virginians face are so serious, and the problems the nation faces are so serious, that it didn't seem to be to me moral to wait 2 years to have a better chance of being elected, but rather important to get into the race and have the most vigorous possible exchange of views in order to provide an alternative for Virginians and for Americans. One of the things that has been a matter of great regret to me is that my opponent has not seen fit to respond to my challenge to get out and debate the issues. I think the only way you can really give Virginians an intelligent basis for choosing is to debate the alternatives, and I think that it would be great if he would come out and join me anytime, any place.
Are you just trying to get exposure so that you have a better chance 2 years from now, or do you really think you have a possibility?
No, my wife has given me permission to make the decision to run in 1976 as a one-time exception to policy. She's made it clear that she controls the veto thereafter. My plan, therefore, is to win in 1976, so I don't have to go back to her for another decision. That
was a yes. Each year, the percentage of senior citizens in Virginia increases. Do you have any program that you have in mind to help these senior citizens, many of which are in very bad circumstances?
Yes, the problems of senior citizens are clearly very, very serious. The do-nothing duo, our senators from Virginia, are clearly uninterested in the problems of our senior citizens and have generally voted against the measures which would have helped to alleviate their problems. There are a range of problems that need to be dealt with. The increasing insecurity of our Social Security system is one. The need for, at the very least, the provision of catastrophic medical care And I would think, if we phase it in intelligently, overall medical care with private medical insurance provided for those that can't otherwise afford it are absolutely urgently needed. I think the problem of finding useful and meaningful contributions for our senior citizens to make to society is a very important problem. These people not only need to feel that they are useful, and they have immense skills and experience available to the society if we can marshal them.
I have another question.
Yes, sir.
In the Tidewater area where I work, and I live up here and come up on the weekend, the fish issue down in our section, that Hopewell situation on the Keypon, what would you do about that situation?
I have been laying out a vigorous program about what is required to deal with this great human tragedy, which is one of the great industrial catastrophes of our modern technological era. Our leadership in Virginia has been abysmal with regard to this problem. The congressman from the district concerned, the two senators representing Virginia in the Senate, the governor, have simply failed to do their duty. They have practiced permissiveness of political leadership and have stood aside from the need to go back and begin to provide assistance to those who are desperately ill as a result, and to begin to remove the poisonous substances from ground, air, and water, which, if we fail to do it, will mean that the poisoning will continue. Indeed, at the present time, there remains in the Hopewell area nearly a ton of Keypon in a pile behind the service station where it was originally fabricated that washes every time it rains into the water. We're continuing to poison and pollute. An absolute abdication of leadership on the part of the people concerned. I have recently advocated that we get federal legislation to make it possible to declare this area a disaster area, that we release the funds that are already available under the Water Authority Control legislation, and that we relocate those people living in the highly poisoned areas, that we scrub the poisonous substances off of the homes, that we go in and remove the topsoil from the area that is excessively poisoned, and that we begin to dredge out the shallows which are poisoned in the water areas and dam over Bailey's Bay, out of which poison is leaking into the river and ultimately into Chesapeake Bay. We're now picking up poisoned fish as far north as New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
What happened to the factories and so forth that are polluting our waters? At 5 years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency said they would sue if they wouldn't clear it up within 5 years. What? I haven't heard of a case yet.
Of course, Allied Chemical is being sued, and there are criminal proceedings against both individuals and as I recall, institutions in connection with this Keypon thing. But I think there is a very real basis for an issue as to whether or not there has been enough done to examine whether or not enforcement is proper. I believe that it's, again, very difficult to understand why the elected representatives from the concerned congressional district and the two senators haven't insisted on a reporting out of the congressional hearings which have already been held on this subject, and why we're sitting by passively, our leaders are, failing to clamor for the additional studies that are needed in order to know how to deal with this spreading tragedy.
We set up a great bureaucracy and then they don't follow through on it.
We have here in Virginia, in this Keypon matter, our own Virginian Andromeda strain, and our leadership has simply failed to address the problem.
I'd like to bring up something. Right after the governor was elected, or soon after, he was quoted in the Washington Post as saying something close to the concept that the Tidewater in Northern Virginia really could no longer be considered as part of the state, or that the two, you could not just govern both parts, that they were so philosophically different. Can you represent us and them down there in the rural areas?
Yes, not only can I, but we must have that kind of representation. The governor is merely the most modern manifestation of the ancient bird machine. That bird machine has always pretended that Virginia didn't exist west of Roanoke, as a result of which the whole southwest region has been disregarded and has economic problems that shouldn't exist. They've always pretended that Northern Virginia wasn't there, even as it began to be heavily settled. Their image of Virginia is the old antebellum South. And we've got to ensure that all Virginians, whether they live in Richmond or Southside or Tidewater or Southwest Virginia or the Shenandoah Valley or Northern Virginia, are represented, and that the problems of all are dealt with. That takes leadership able to deal with the modern industrial technological society, not leadership that lives in the past.
I think we should tell him that George Washington was a Northern Virginian.
Yes, that's right, and George Mason and others. Even Robert E. Lee.
Are you able to address to the Tidewater and the area away from here the domestic problems as well as you can the military problems, because your image in the military field is of course well known, but I don't think those people are more as interested in the national defense as they are in more local problems.
Yes, I have found that the problems that are of primary interest to Virginians as I travel around are really four in number. First and most important on people's minds is the cost of living problem and the fact that it's getting tougher and tougher to meet the monthly bills. Second is the unemployment problem, the greatest unemployment since the Great Depression, brought on by the Nixon-Ford-Kissinger era. Third is the failure of the administration and the Congress to deal with the energy crisis, as the average Virginian sees that crisis in his gasoline bills, his electrical bills, his heating bills. And then fourth, there's great concern around Virginia about the rising crime rate and failure to move in and try to provide solutions to it. Now, if you go beyond those first four, you do find that many Virginians are quite interested in the need for a truth in packaging policy with regard to what is happening in our foreign affairs and in the shifting military balance. And I haven't found any Virginians yet that feel comfortable with the fact that we have become number two. Most of them believe that it's dead wrong for that to have been permitted to happen, and it's even worse for the Nixon, Ford, Kissinger administration to pretend that it hasn't happened.
Well, I wonder, what difference does it make if we're number two, if both we and the Soviet Union could kill each other 10 times over, nuclear weapons? I mean, does it really matter?
If that were the case, I don't think it would really matter. The fact of the matter is that if one examines the studies in great depth, what happens now that the Soviet Union has been permitted to achieve strategic nuclear superiority, as Paul Nitze, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense and SALT negotiator, described it, the Soviet Union with a civil defense capability to evacuate its populations, to feed them and water them from pre-stocked areas, to put some of them underground, with some of its factories underground and more of them going underground, has the capability to evacuate its populations and strike first. And should they do so, then 100 to 160 million Americans would die. ...are not free goods, but are contingent upon Soviet willingness to join both sides with fair and balanced field with regard to expenditure. But we can't fool ourselves, and we can't fool the Congress. The administration has got to level with us in order for our process to work.
Except, sir, are we actually trying to convince the Russians to reduce their expenditure on defense or on foreign aid of regimes when, in effect, the United States has been increasing steadily?
No, the fact of the matter is that in terms of dollars per year, U.S. expenditures have increased. In terms of constant dollars, U.S. expenditures have decreased every year. We're at the smallest constant dollar budget since 1950 for defense. We're at the smallest fraction of the federal budget for defense since 1950. We're at the smallest fraction of the gross national product for defense since 1950. We put in 5% of our gross national product, while the Soviets put in 15% of theirs, as a result of which they outspend us by 60% in the strategic field and 40% in the conventional military field.
Except one thing, a 5% change in the expense rate, expenditure on a military commitment in the United States is not necessarily a lot less than the 15% change.
No, it is. The Soviet Union GNP is 60% of ours. They outspend us in terms of dollars per year by putting 15% of theirs in while we put 5% of ours. That's why they outspend us in terms of dollars per year by 60% in the strategic field and 40% in the conventional field. This is the information that Jim Schlesinger got fired for trying to distribute to the American people.
If I recall correctly, in the Washington Post or the New York Times recently, there was some news release on the expenditure of the U.S. versus Russia in its nuclear capability and its military weapon system. And according to that article, I believe the United States was still outspending dollar for dollar and output for output.
You know, you can read anything you want to find in the newspapers. Some of it is accurate and some of it is inaccurate. Believe me, the studies that have been done to persuade the American people to reduce still further their defense budgets are generally catastrophically wrong. Those who would cut defense budgets will tell you that we have more tons of ships than the Soviets. That's right. I'll tell you that they have more tons of warships than we have, and that's right. Those who would cut will tell you our submarines are better. That's correct. I'll tell you they've got 2.5 times as many, and that's correct. And all of those citations are kind of meaningless. What you have to do is examine who wins and who loses. When you get beyond the conventional wisdom and look at the outcomes of a strategic nuclear exchange, the experts who have looked at it, former Secretary Schlesinger, former Secretary Laird, former Deputy Secretary of Defense Nitze, those of us who were in the tank will tell you that the Soviets win and we lose that kind of war. If you look at the conventional military outcomes, the odds are very high that the Soviet Union will defeat us today because of the fact that they have been permitted to outspend us. This is why Secretary of Defense Schlesinger got fired. He was trying to get these facts out.
Except one thing. In my opinion, I would imagine that the Soviet Union would be just afraid of going into war with us as we would with them.
The Soviet Union wants very much to avoid war. The Soviet Union believes and says that they will force the West to continue to accommodate to their initiatives under the umbrella of their military superiority. They watch us as carefully as a doctor monitors the fever chart of his patient. And the moment a president and a secretary of state began to be honest with the public and the Congress and began to get up and say, these are the facts, you would see Soviet behavior improving dramatically. The message would go from Dobrynin here in Washington. Mm-hmm. The message would go from Arbatov at the American Institute in Moscow. Hey, fellas, cool it. The natives are getting restless. Practice true detente for a while and put them back to sleep again.
Are you then in favor of more openness in government to the public so that the American public can understand the issues better?
Absolutely.
So that they can make decisions on who to elect and who not to elect?
Absolutely. That's why I have been advocating a truth in packaging policy. That's why I believe that Secretary Kissinger is a great historical disaster.
In my opinion, I think he's more concerned about the Middle East and Israel than he is about some of the true friends that America has.
Well, I think his problem is a different one. I think his problem, as he has said it to me, and as he has said it to others, but will never admit publicly, is that he believes the Soviet Empire is the wave of the future. He has said that he believes the United States is a civilization in decline, and that the American people lack the will and the toughness to give him the necessary negotiating strength, and that his job, therefore, like Chamberlain's, is to achieve the best, second best position he can achieve.
Okay.
And that, in itself, is not as dangerous as his willingness to deceive the public and the Congress that is his true intention.
Okay. Are you assuming, then, that he takes the position of an appeaser?